Hi, welcome everyone. Time to start our second session. I'm thankful that all of you guys are here. Once again, this is a reminder before we get started. If we're Mandarin speaking only, please go into the youth worship room. There the translations will be happening. But if you go over there, there's not going to be Q&A for you over here on this side. Mr. Manuel. Okay. If not, let's bow our heads. Will you pray with me? Gracious God in heaven, I thank you for your favor and love for us. We thank you, God, that you would bring Alan here to teach us, to help us to understand, and to make sense of everything that's going on, Lord, especially with this world that we live in. God, we ask for your edification. Will your spirit open our hearts, open our minds, that we may truly know what your will is. Father, that you would give us insight into the things that you call us to. Lord, bless this time. We thank you for your anointing over Alan. We thank you for all that you do. We bless you, Father. We pray all these things in Jesus' name.
Amen.
Will you give a warm round of applause for Alan? And one side note, in between this, between 4 and 4:20, there will be refreshments served in the MPR. Okay? 4 and 4:20.
Yeah. Well, good afternoon. Amen. Welcome back to those of you who are joining us again that were here last night, and then welcome to all the new people who were not here yesterday. I hope you'll be able to sort of catch up on some of the material that we are covering this weekend. I made mention yesterday that my ethnic background is Assyrian, which I mentioned is a very old group of people from the part of the world called Mesopotamia or Iraq, which is where my family is from. And of course, you know, in the Bible, the Assyrians are talked a lot about in the Bible. I mentioned that also last night. If you've ever studied world history, you'll also probably have read about the Assyrians, because they were actually known for being very brutal, ruthless people. Brave warriors, but very, very ruthless and very brutal. In fact, we were known to do some terrible things to our enemies. We would chop off our enemies' heads, and we'd throw the heads against the walls, or we'd gouge out people's eyeballs. We would skin people alive. We would take our enemies, bodies, and we'd light them on fire and put them on stakes and use their burning bodies as light for our parties at night. But we're a lot nicer now. In fact, if you talk to me, you'll find I'm very friendly. Thankfully, we repented at the preaching of Jonah. So you can study about the Ninevites and my people in the book of Jonah. But we're much nicer. I won't kill you if you ask me a question. All right. Well, I want to turn our attention to this topic. And over the years, I've had many opportunities to attend debates where there has been a Christian debating an atheist over the question of God's existence. And one of the most common objections that an atheist would raise against the Christian view is that there cannot be a God because there is so much evil in the world. And so one of the questions that the atheist will ask is, how can you make sense of this world? How can you say there is a God when there is so much evil in the world? Now, to be fair, this is a legitimate question. There's no problem. It is a good question. And there's many ways to answer this question. I'm not here to talk about the problem of evil. But in the process of answering this objection, we Christians, and indeed many people who are theists, we also point out that in addition to being there a lot of good evidence for God's existence, we also see that God has created three institutions on earth to mitigate the impact of evil, to lessen the impact of evil. And one of those institutions that God has created is called the government. The government, as we read in Romans 13:4, is an institution that is created by God, and it says the government are including authorities that are agents of wrath that are supposed to bring punishment on evildoers. 1 Peter 2:14 also says that the government is given by God to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. And that's why when governments become corrupt, evil flourishes. So you see, the government is one institution that God has created to mitigate, to lessen the impact of evil in the world. But God has given us a second institution, and that is the church. The church is an institution that God has created, and when Christians follow the teachings of the Bible, what we see is that they are called to repair and rescue a broken world. And so when Christians follow the consistent teachings of the Bible, we see that the poor and the homeless are served. We see that widows are taken care of. We see that children are protected. And we defend innocent people and those who are vulnerable. So this is the second institution that God has given humanity to lessen the impact of evil. God's given us the government. God's given us the church. But there is a third institution that God has given us, and that is the family. The family is the fundamental unit of society. And in fact, stable, monogamous, long-term heterosexual unions not only stabilize society, they literally create society. And families civilize men, families protect women, families create the optimal environment to raise children. And that's why when families are destroyed or damaged through divorce or through death, people are hurt. And so now we have seen a new attack on the family through the introduction of same-sex marriage or other alternate forms of marriage. And so today I want to address how we respond to the challenge of same-sex marriage. Now, if you were here yesterday, you'll probably recall that we have a lot of biblical reasons for why we would oppose same-sex marriage, right? I mean, the Genesis account of creation shows that God created humanity and instituted marriage to be only between a man and a woman. And then we see even Jesus summarizing this model in Matthew 19, where he reaffirms the biblical creation account of Genesis and says this is a valid institution. And as I pointed out, one way to summarize Jesus' view on sex and marriage is that it's about one man with one woman becoming one flesh for one lifetime, right? This is Jesus' view. So it is a Genesis institution. It's an institution by God created in the Genesis account, but then reemphasized by Jesus in the New Testament. Now, we have this biblical view, this biblical position and justification for our view. But as you know, many people in our culture reject the Bible. They do not accept the teachings of Scripture. And so for us to simply appeal to the Bible would, you know, fall on deaf ears. Because people say, well, that's nice, you Christians believe in the Bible, but we don't. So why should we accept your understanding of marriage? Why should we not accept same-sex marriage? And so this is the problem with the approach of merely looking at the Bible. And so I want to offer you an alternative approach to dealing with the challenge of same-sex marriage. Since same-sex marriage is a public policy issue, we as Christians need to learn how to raise public policy concerns. Okay? Since same-sex marriage is a public policy issue, we as Christians need to learn how to raise public policy concerns. And I believe if we want to be savvy ambassadors for Jesus Christ, if we want to be thoughtful and clever and mindful of how the culture operates, we can't just know biblical arguments, we should also know secular arguments. And as I said yesterday, there's nothing anti-God about making an intelligent, reasoned case against something, even if we don't appeal to the Bible. Again, we can appeal to the Bible, but I want to offer you some arguments that do not appeal to the Bible so that you will be more persuasive to people who do not accept the Bible as legitimate. And so my case against same-sex marriage is not going to be a religious case. It's not going to be based upon God or based upon the Bible. Okay? And in fact, my case against same-sex marriage makes no judgment about the nature of homosexuality. Now, of course, as you know from yesterday, I do believe that homosexual behavior is a sin, of course. But you don't even have to believe that in order to accept the case that I'm going to make, that same-sex marriage should not be permitted in a culture. And I'll just add, that my case against same-sex marriage is not about hate or homophobia. Anybody who knows me and my family, my wife and my kids, and those around me knows that we have welcomed friends and family who identify as gay and lesbian to our homes. We have been friends with them for years. We love them dearly. This does not come at all from a position of hate. In fact, there are many same-sex married people, or I should say, same-sex relationship people that oppose same-sex marriage. Okay, because again, you can make a case against same-sex marriage without appealing to God. All right. Now, my argument against same-sex marriage is going to be based on the definition of two things. Number one, on the definition of the role of government, and number two, on the definition of the role of family. So I'm going to first define what is government and what is its role, and then I'm going to define what is a family and what is its role, and then once we have those two definitions, the case against same-sex marriage will make more sense. Okay? So first, let's talk about the nature of government power. What is the nature of the legitimate use of government power in light of our right to liberty, which is a very American institution, but nevertheless, I think it's relevant here. So here is what I believe is the proper understanding of the role of government. The government should not interfere in the private affairs of its citizens, either to restrict, regulate, or control, unless it has some compelling reason to do so. Okay, so in other words, the government should be hands-off in general. It should not be interfering in the personal lives of people unless there's some reason why it should intervene. Okay, this is the principle of limited government that we have understood in the United States. Many years ago, people used to say, you know, the government should just stay out of the lives of people's bedrooms. The government should stay out of people's bedrooms, right? Well, I largely agree with that sentiment. I think the government should stay out of people's bedrooms. It shouldn't be involved in what people do in their bedrooms, okay? And so I think this characterizes the nature of government power, right? Now, what about the definition of the family, okay? I think the definition of the family is fairly self-evident, but here's how I would put it. Committed, long-term, monogamous, heterosexual unions, as a rule, as a group, and by nature, produce the next generation. I'm going to unpack that in just a moment, but let me repeat it. Families are about committed, long-term, monogamous, heterosexual unions that, as a rule, as a group, by nature, produce the next generation. Now, what do I mean by that? When I say as a rule, I simply mean that most individual couples produce kids. Now, of course, there are exceptions to the rule, of course, but we don't base policy on the exceptions. But as a rule, when you bring a heterosexual couple together, they produce kids. Okay? Now, I say as a group. What I mean by that is it is the group of heterosexual couples, like this heterosexual couple, this couple, this couple, this couple. You take that group of heterosexual couples, it is that group that is largely responsible for producing the next generation. Notice, if I took the group of chess champions, is that group responsible for producing the next generation? No. What about sorority sisters? Or tennis partners. No. Notice, those groups of people are not largely responsible for producing the next generation. But long-term monogamous heterosexual unions are, as a group, the ones who are primarily responsible for producing children. Okay? And then when I say by nature, I just mean that it is through the natural activities, sexual activity of a heterosexual couple that produces kids. Now you might say, well, you could, through in vitro fertilization or through cloning, create humans. It's true. Yeah, you can, through biotechnologies, could do it. But that's why I say by nature. You know, heterosexual couples, by their very natural and normal nature, produce children. Okay? Now, the families that long-term monogamous heterosexual unions, as a rule, as a group by nature, produce. These families are literally the building blocks of civilization. And they create the most stable and advantageous environment for raising children, which not only creates a stable society, it literally makes society possible. Okay, so now, notice we have two definitions. The definition of government and the definition of the family. Government, remember, is the government should stay out of the lives of its private citizens unless it has some reason to get involved. And the family, remember, is defined as long-term monogamous heterosexual unions, as a rule, as a group, by nature, produce the next generation. Okay, now that we have those two definitions, let me make my case against same-sex marriage. My argument is simple. The government does have a compelling reason to intervene, to get involved in long-term monogamous heterosexual unions. Why? Because it's those unions in particular that are the only ones that, as a rule, as a group, by nature, produce the next generation. So remember I said the government should stay out of the lives of people's business unless it has some reason to do so? Well, guess what? When it comes to monogamous heterosexual unions, it has a reason to get involved because it's these particular couples that produce the next generation and make society possible. And the government has a vested interest in securing and protecting the future of society. So what does the government do? It intervenes. It creates laws to protect and privilege these heterosexual couplings because they literally produce society. In fact, many years ago, there was a thing called the Defense of Marriage Act. It was signed by President Bill Clinton, who, as you might know, today is a proponent of same-sex marriage. But at the time that he was president, he signed this act. Listen to the words of this act. It says this: at bottom, civil society has an interest in maintaining and protecting the institution of heterosexual marriage because it has a deep and abiding interest in encouraging responsible procreation and child-rearing. Simply put, government has an interest in marriage because it has an interest in children. Like, that's totally obvious, right? Why should the government get involved and create laws and tax breaks and all these things and protections for heterosexual couples? Because they produce kids, and kids are the future of our society. Without that, society crumbles. So this is like so obvious that they would sign such a thing. This is why the government gets involved. Again, normally the government should be hands-off. You want to build a business? Well, go build a business. You want to open up a park? Start a park, you know? You want a family? All right, great. But families? Man, Harrison, wow, the government wants to encourage that, so it's going to get involved. Okay? Now, having said that, the government does not have a reason to intervene in any other relationship. Because no other relationship functions the way a heterosexual couple relationship does. The government does not have a compelling reason to get involved in any same-sex relationship or any other relationship whatsoever because no other relationship has the unique function that a heterosexual relationship does. Right? No other relationship, as a rule, as a group, by nature, produces the next generation. Let me give you some examples. Consider two brothers. Take two brothers. They have a relationship, right? I have an older brother. We have a relationship. Okay? Do brothers, as a rule, as a group, by nature, produce the next generation? No, they don't. So this is why the government does not care about intervening in the relationship of two brothers and creating laws to protect them or giving them tax breaks. It doesn't. The government is hands-off when it comes to two brothers. What about tennis partners? Do tennis partners, as a rule, as a group, by nature, produce the next generation? No. They play tennis together, okay? That's great. Woo, woo, let's watch tennis. Wonderful. But they don't do that. So guess what? The government does not have a vested interest in intervening in their relationship and protecting them and creating laws that give tennis partners tax breaks. Because they don't, as a rule, as a group by nature, produce next generation. What about mothers and sons? Do mothers and sons, they have a relationship, but do they, as a rule, as a group, by nature, produce the next generation? No. That's why the government doesn't get involved. Okay. What about chess champions? Right? Do they, as a rule, as a group, by nature, produce the next generation? No. That's why the government doesn't get involved in their relationship. What about two male friends? Like, I have a couple of friends. They're guys. We have an accountability relationship. We've been friends for, like, 20 years. Okay? Now, my friend, I'll just give you an example. One of my friends' name is Steve. Lives in Kansas. He lives in Virginia. Okay? Lives in Virginia. We've been friends for 20 years. He's married. He's got kids. I'm married. I got kids. We're good friends. We're, like, best friends almost. Okay? Does our friendship, are we the kind of couple that produces the next generation as a rule, as a group by nature? No. And that's why the government does not have any vested interest in intervening in our relationship and creating laws and protecting it and giving it a label. Okay, so what about two men, two gay men? Do two gay men, as a rule, as a group, by nature, produce the next generation? No, they don't. In fact, they are, in principle, incapable of doing that. Okay, because the same-sex sex act is, by definition, an infertile act. Okay, so this is why the government has historically never got involved in the relationship of two gay men. Because they don't, as a rule, as a group, by nature, produce next generation. So the government has no interest in getting involved in securing and protecting it and giving it tax breaks. What about two lesbian women? Do they, as a rule, as a group, by nature, produce the next generation? Again, the answer is no. And that's why historically, no government has gotten involved and said, okay, I'm going to protect and privilege your relationship. Because they don't do that. This is why I say that the state doesn't get involved in these relationships, nor has it ever in the past. Okay? Now notice something significant about the state's intervention in the only relationship that matters, which is the heterosexual relationship, right? Notice this, something about this. The government did not create marriage. Okay? The state did not create marriage, so therefore the state cannot redefine what it is. Marriage is a pre-political institution. Meaning that the government looks back into history and says, okay, it's interesting. This guy and this girl, they come together and they form a coupling. Okay? And these couplings, after they stay together for a while, they produce kids. And now they're a family. And so the government looks into history and sees, yes, men and women come together and form these couplings that produce kids that make families. So marriage is something that exists before the government ever exists. All the government does is recognize what already exists and then creates laws to protect that thing that already exists. And this is why since the government did not create marriage, it should not have the right to redefine it. Let me give you an illustration on another topic. Think about, in the United States, our right to life. Now, don't think like abortion. I just mean like, you and I, we have a right to live, right? The state can't just come and kill us for no reason, right? Now, where in the United States does our right to life come from? Does anybody know the answer to this? In the United States, okay, that's right. It's the Declaration of Independence, right? So the state in the United States says that all men are created equal and are endowed by their, who? Creator with certain inalienable rights, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So in the United States, your right to life is inherent in you, is given to you by your Creator. So notice what the United States government does. It says, wait a minute. It looks into the past and says, Humans are the kind of being that has the right to life given to them by their Creator. Notice, the state, the government, did not invent your right to life. It merely recognized what already existed, that humans have a right to life, and then it creates laws to protect that right. Homicide laws, murder laws, right? All those laws is not what created your right to life. It merely simply recognized you had a right to life that existed before, and now it's created these laws to protect that right to life. What would we think of the United States if it then took your right to life and altered it or removed it? Would we consider that decision moral or immoral by the United States government? Yeah, immoral. Because the United States did not invent the right to life. It just recognized it already existed and created laws to protect it. In the same way, the government did not invent marriage. It simply recognized it already existed and then created laws to protect and affirm it and encourage it. And that's why the state going in to redefine something it did not create is also an immoral act. So that's my foundational premise behind a case against same-sex marriage that is not based on, say, the Bible, okay, right? Number one, it's based on the nature of the role of government and the nature of family. And so this is just sort of a qualification as to why it shouldn't have the right to make any alterations to it. But we have further evidence against same-sex marriage, and that is that same-sex marriage harms children. Okay? We have decades of research that show that children do best when they're raised by their biological mothers and biological fathers in a long-term marriage. Now, this is not, I'm not talking about people who are adopted. Of course, you, if you're adopted or if you've adopted a child, you could be a wonderful child, you could be a wonderful parent. Okay, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about in general. If you look at the overall situation, children do best when they're raised by their biological mothers and fathers. Notice, same-sex marriage, by design, will always deny a child their mother or their father or both. In every instance where you have a child in a same-sex marriage, they will always be denied their mother or their father or both. And they'll miss out on at least one gender influence. Okay, so if you're raised by two women, you'll miss out on the gender influence of a male. If you're raised by two men, you'll be missing out on the gender influence of a female. Okay? And so by legalizing same-sex marriage, what the United States has done is we have declared by law that mothers and fathers are interchangeable. Right? In other words, a mother offers no unique contribution to her role as a parent. A man could achieve all of the functions that a mother can provide. That's what this law says. And a father provides no unique contribution to his role as a parent. Two women could just as well achieve what a man and a woman were to achieve. Now, we don't have to wonder what kind of an effect this is going to have, because we've actually have had dozens and indeed hundreds of studies that already have researched the impact of denying children a mother or a father. In fact, there are 351 studies done that have been looked at this, over 800 surveys, across 13 countries, over 5 continents, and the results of all of this research are astonishingly consistent. And that is this: married mothers and fathers are the gold standard when it comes to raising children. Whenever you deviate from this standard, bad things happen. In fact, children suffer in virtually every measure of well-being. For example, they have higher levels of physical and mental illness when you deviate from this gold standard. They have higher levels of educational failure, poverty, substance abuse, criminal behavior, loneliness, physical abuse, and sexual abuse. And so a compassionate and moral society comes to the aid of motherless and fatherless children. We don't create families that intentionally deny a child their mother or father, but that's what same-sex marriage does. It literally creates, by design, a family where a child denies their mother or their father or both. And indeed, really, it doesn't even have to be two men or two women. It could be any arrangement. Three men and two women. Four men and one woman. Five women and one man. Any arrangement could potentially be possible in this new world that we live in. So what same-sex marriage then is doing is it shifts our attention from the needs of children to the wants of parents. Right? And so whenever that happens, the children's needs are forgotten. Children no longer have a right to parents. Rather, couples have a right to children. Children become like a commodity. Children become like the next thing somebody wants, you know. So Elton John, well-known singer, he's like, I want a new house. He gets his house. I want a best-selling album. Gets his best-selling album. I want a child. I want a car. I want to live in Hawaii. And so a child just becomes another thing in this long list of wants. Because now adults, we want this, we want that. And they're just, children are a commodity. And so the needs of children are then forgotten. Lesbian parent Rosie O'Donnell, many of you maybe have heard of Rosie O'Donnell. She's kind of an American comedian. She's been on TV. She's been in a talk show program. So she's here with her partner and with her son. His name is Parker. And she was interviewed on a national TV show on ABC hosted by Diane Sawyer, who's a well-known TV personality. And Diane Sawyer asked Rosie O'Donnell on national television, has your son ever asked to have a father? And she said, yes. Parker one time asked Rosie O'Donnell, Mommy, why can't I have a daddy? And listen to Rosie's answer. She said, because I'm the kind of mommy who wants another mommy. Notice, her son expresses a concern and a desire to have a father in his life. But his need for a father is disregarded in light of the adult's wants. Well, I don't want to be married to a man. I want to be married to a woman. So whatever your needs are irrelevant and secondary to my wants. And this is why I say same-sex marriage shifts our attention from the needs of children to the wants of parents. And indeed, there are like many studies now that show the effects of this that have been published in peer-reviewed secular journals. This one was published in Social Science Research, and this was done actually in a it looked at the outcome of children who are raised by same-sex parents and heterosexual parents. And it said that the children of homosexuals did worse in 77 out of 80 outcome measures when this was done. Another study performed, this was done in Canada, where they've actually had legalized same-sex marriage far longer than in the United States, and looked at graduation rates of children raised by same-sex couples and heterosexual couples, and they found that children living with gay and lesbian families were 65% as likely to graduate compared to children living in opposite-sex families. Okay, and you can't even pass this off as like legal, financial limitations, because actually in Canada, same-sex couples have had all the taxation and all the government benefits since back in 1997. So, you know, we're talking at least 20 years or so. So again, same-sex marriage by definition should not be redefined by the state. Number two, same-sex marriage harms children. Number three, again, another secular argument against same-sex marriage, it will restrict the rights of religious groups and individuals, right? So here's another reason why we shouldn't allow for same-sex marriage. When you legalize same-sex marriage, then what happens is that religious freedoms will be increasingly restricted over time. And there's one word why this will happen, and the word is consistency. Because now, today, the state holds two contradictory positions. On the one hand, the state, the government, endorses same-sex marriage, But on the other hand, the state also gives financial privileges and benefits to churches like yours and to pastors and individuals like me or your pastor. We get tax breaks. And yet we and your church probably is opposed to same-sex marriage and teaches against it. Well, this is a clear inconsistency in the law. The government is saying same-sex marriage is legal, but the government is also giving tax breaks to people like pastors and churches. Well, guess what? It's only a matter of time that attorneys they already know about the inconsistency, but will find opportunities to exploit that inconsistency and remove the protections that are given to religious individuals. And virtually every expert you ask will agree on this, whether they're pro same-sex marriage or against same-sex marriage. Anthony Piccarello is just one of them who talks about this. He says that there's going to be a point of conflict between the church and the state on this matter. Okay, I'm not going to read the whole thing there. And we see a whole bunch of examples where now people who are religious, Christian or otherwise, are being challenged in court because they haven't accepted what the state deems to be the legitimate way to see marriage. And so you can see churches losing their tax exemption status, you can see individuals losing their tax exemption status, and what you'd imagine is a ton of lawsuits. And there's a bunch of examples of this. Take one example, Elaine Photography. So Elaine Photography, she's a Christian photographer, her name's Elaine. She was asked by a lesbian couple to photograph their ceremony. Now Elaine said, well, I can't. My own conscience says that I can't participate in using my creative talents and gifts to make something like a lesbian ceremony look beautiful. It violates my religious conscience. Okay? So, she said, I can't do it. The lesbian couple found another photographer for less money to photograph their wedding. But after that was over, they came back and sued Elaine. And they filed a complaint with the Human Rights Commission, and Elaine was charged with order to pay $6,637.94 because she refused to photograph a lesbian ceremony. Another case. And the justice, get this, just to make matters worse, in case you thought, well, this is just a fluke or maybe they didn't understand what they were saying, listen to what the justice said. Elaine and her husband are, quote, compelled by law to compromise the very religious beliefs that inspire their lives. It's the price of citizenship. You want to be a U.S. citizen? You got to compromise your religious convictions. That's what it takes. You can't live in this country anymore unless you're willing to do that. It's unbelievable. Another example, Aaron and Melissa Klein, maybe you've heard of this story, very famous. They own Sweet Cakes Bakery, or they did. So they would make, they bake cakes, right? And so they were asked by a lesbian couple back in 2013 to bake a cake for their lesbian wedding ceremony. And they said, look, we can't do that because it violates our conscience. We're Christians and we don't believe in that. And, there's plenty of other people who will do it. So, just go to them. Don't ask us to do it. Well, as you can imagine, in Oregon, the judge there ordered the lesbian women to receive a payment, forget this, $135,000. Why was it so much? Because the lesbian women claimed they endured emotional suffering. What did that emotional suffering entail? It's listed in the court case. It says this. The lesbian women felt and experienced symptoms of, here's the list, acute loss of confidence, doubt, excessive sleep. They felt mentally raped, dirty and shameful. They had high blood pressure, impaired digestion, loss of appetite, migraine headaches, pale and sick at home after work, resumption of their smoking habit, shock, stunned, surprise, uncertainty, weight gain, and worry. Those were all the symptoms they experienced for not having a cake baked for them. And that's why the bill was $135,000. It wasn't a bill, it was a fine, basically. For following their own conscience, basically. Now, in today's age, if you need to raise a lot of money, what do most millennials do today to raise money? What's the way that people raise money now publicly? Yeah. So like a GoFundMe account, right? So that's what they did. They said, well, you know, these poor people, they're bakers, right? You think they got $135,000 sitting around? No. So they opened up a GoFundMe account to help them pay for their fees. In 9 hours, they raised $100,000. But guess what? GoFundMe said, well, we don't agree with Aaron and Melissa Klein, so we're going to shut down their account so they can't raise any more money. So listen to this. GoFundMe says, we have our own conscience that says we don't want to do business with Aaron and Melissa Klein. And they're allowed to do that, but Aaron and Melissa Klein are not allowed to say that their conscience doesn't want to participate in a lesbian ceremony. Now, to GoFundMe's credit, they did give them the money, but they stopped any more donations to their account. Bernal Stutzman as well, she's a florist. She had a friend who was a gay man for 10 years who used to come in and she would, you know, do floral arrangements for him, give him flowers, whatever. But one day when he decided to get married, he asked her to do floral arrangements for his wedding, and she said no. And as you can imagine, she was forced to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to the ACLU for that violation. And she received and said, she says, this guy was my friend. Like, I served him floral arrangements for 10 years. And then he turns around and sues me. Another example, Blaine Anderson, Hands on Originals. This guy, it's basically a t-shirt company. And he would print various things on t-shirts. So if you wanted a t-shirt for your church missions trip, you know, whatever, you'd go to him or go to, you know, anyone. And he'd print whatever logo or image on the shirt. Well, an LGBT group asked him to print a shirt promoting a gay pride parade. He said, well, I can't use my creative talents to endorse a message that I disagree with. And of course, the Human Rights Commission declared this as illegal discrimination and ordered him to print the shirts. Now, keep in mind, this guy, in the past, declined to serve a female biker group because they had on their, they wanted him to print shirts that said biker, B-I-T-C-H-E-S, okay, on the thing. So he said, no, I can't do that. That's just too vulgar. I don't want to do that. There was a youth group that asked him to print a shirt showing Jesus selling fried chicken. He said, I can't do that. I feel like it's kind of being disrespectful towards Jesus, you know? There's a church that said, print a shirt that says homosexuality is sin. And although he believes it, he says, that's just so tacky. I'm not going to do that. So he's been declining many requests to have a whole bunch of things printed. This wasn't the first time. And so when he declined to do a gay pride parade, that point, oh, now the lawsuits came. Now, the Alliance Defending Freedom did appeal his case, and he actually won in this case, which is a rare, wonderful thing. They said, you know what? He does have the right to not promote a message. So that was a rare situation when it actually worked. Okay. So this is a third example of why we shouldn't allow for same-sex marriage, is that it now restricts the rights of religious groups and individuals. Here's another reason. Same-sex marriage now eliminates the justification to deny other forms of marriage. Because think about it for a moment. Once you say marriage is no longer just between one man and one woman, once you now open up the definition to something else, how is it possible to restrict the definition to anything? Like, if it can be two men or two women, why can't it be any arrangement of men and women? Right? Because once you open up the definition of marriage, there's no reason why you should restrict it. And people say, oh, Alan, that's ridiculous. That's like the slippery slope fallacy. That'll never happen. Well, yeah, it is ridiculous, but it's definitely happening already. I mean, this is old news now. But now people who are advocating incestuous marriage or polyamorous marriage are claiming to also want to be included in the definition of marriage. In fact, in California, when we legalized same-sex marriage back in, I think it was 2008, Justice Marvin Baxter, a Supreme Court, the California Supreme Court, said this. Now that we've legalized same-sex marriage, who can say that in 10, 15, or 20 years, an activist court might not rely on the majority's analysis to conclude, on the basis of a perceived evolution in community values, that laws prohibiting polygamous and incestuous marriages were no longer constitutionally justified? That's just fancy phrase for saying, look, now that same-sex marriage is legal, why not have family members who want to marry each other? Or why not polygamy? Why can't they marry? You know, why not? What's to limit that? He said nothing. And of course, that's what we see. Elizabeth Emmons, a well-known advocate for polyamorous marriage, said this: "We view this historical moment when same-sex couples begin to enter in the institution of marriage as a unique opportunity to question the mandate of compulsory monogamy." Meaning, why just have two people in marriage? Why not three, four, five? Why not have 10 people in a marriage? Kent Greenfield is a Boston College law professor who actually, he's in favor of same-sex marriage. He said, there is a slippery slope to polygamous and incestuous marriage. He says, you legalize same-sex marriage, there's no reason why now that you can't have polygamous marriage or incestuous marriage. And listen to what he says. He goes, you know those opponents of marriage equality, people like me, right, who said that government approval of same-sex marriage might erode bans on polygamous and incestuous marriages? They're right. So when we were having this debate in America, we Christians used to say, look, if you legalize same-sex marriage, the next thing is going to be polygamy and incestuous marriage and all these other things. And everybody said, oh, that's ridiculous. He said, you know what? Those people were totally right. And he's pro-same-sex marriage, so he has no reason to agree with us, but he is. He's saying, of course, you legalize same-sex marriage, you now have polygamy, you now have incestuous marriage, whatever you want. Anything goes. Now, those are three or four, if you will, arguments against same-sex marriage. I want to now respond to two common objections that are raised against my view. Okay? The first one is the most intellectually robust one, and it's a legal challenge, all right? And here is what the challenge went. They said, look, if you deny marriage to same-sex couples, this is unequal protection under the law. Because heterosexuals have a right, they can get married, but homosexuals do not have a right, they can't get married. Do you see how the marriage law does not apply equally to both? This is unfair. This is unequal protection under the law. Now, that's a legitimate argument, okay? So I want to respond to this argument because it's the most substantial one. But when I respond to it, you're going to think that I'm playing a trick on you. Because my response is so simple and obvious, you'll think that can't be just enough to refute this, okay? But it is. But I just want you to know, it's not a trick. This isn't like clever sophistry, all right? Let me explain to you why I completely disagree with this, that I think that the marriage law was always fair and equal. So listen carefully. Any homosexual had the... let's just go back 10 years when there was no same-sex marriage in America, okay? At that point, any homosexual had the right to marry anyone in any state and get all the privileges that they wanted as long as they married someone of the opposite sex. I think, well, wait a minute, Alan. If they're homosexual, they don't want to marry someone of the opposite sex. They want to marry someone of the same sex. Yes, that's true. They might want that, but they were not being denied any rights or any privileges. Listen very carefully here. Homosexuals have always had the same rights and the same restrictions as heterosexuals. Think about it for a moment. Even before same-sex marriage was legal, a homosexual man could marry another person in any state as long as it was someone of the opposite sex. That was the same right that I, as a heterosexual, had. If I wanted to marry someone, I could marry in any state as long as there is someone of the opposite sex, right? So notice, the homosexual and me, the heterosexual, had the same rights. We both could marry a woman and get all the privileges of marriage. But we not only had the same rights, we both also had the same restrictions. Think about it. A homosexual could not marry someone who's a close blood relative. Neither could I as a heterosexual. I could not marry a close blood relative. A homosexual could not marry a child. I could not marry a child. A homosexual could not marry a person already married. I also could not marry a person already married. And a homosexual person could not marry another man, nor could I marry another man. Notice, the homosexual had the same rights and the same restrictions as a heterosexual. There was never any unequal protection under the law. Both the homosexual and the heterosexual have the same rights, had the same rights, and had the same restrictions. Okay? Let me give you an illustration. This is what I mean by that. Consider two people, Smith and Jones. Okay? And now Smith and Jones live in the United States and are United States citizens. Let me ask you an obvious question. Which country can Smith and Jones vote in? The United States, okay? Now, what if Jones, let's say he doesn't care about American politics. He loves France, and he wants to vote in France. Does Jones have a right to vote in France? What if he has a desire to vote in France? Does that give him the right to vote in France? No. Now, can Jones say, wait a minute, this is not fair. Smith has a right that I don't have. Smith can vote in America, but I can't vote in France. Is that a legitimate objection? No. Notice that Smith and Jones both have the same right. Both of them can vote in America. And both of them have the same restriction. Neither one of them can vote in France. It just so happens that Jones has a desire to vote in France. Okay, yeah, maybe he has got a different desire, but there's no unequal protection of the voting law. The voting law applied equally to both Smith and Jones. The voting law says they both have a right to vote in America, and they both do not have a right to vote in France. And the same is happening with, or was happening with, the marriage laws. Smith and Jones in America had a right to marry a woman. Jones just had a desire to marry a man. But again, Smith and Jones have the same rights and they have the same restrictions. Both can marry a woman, neither one can marry a man. So notice the marriage law applied equally to both Smith and Jones. The marriage law always applied equally to both heterosexuals and homosexuals. There was never any unequal protection under the law. That was a false argument. Homosexuals have always had the same rights and the same restrictions as heterosexuals. In fact, here's the way I summarize this point. I ask, when I used to have these conversations with a homosexual man, I ask the homosexual person, here's how I know this is true. I said, give me the first and last name of a person that I can marry that you also cannot also marry. Right? Give me the first and last name of a person that I can marry that you cannot also marry. Do you know what answer I got? Nothing. Because anyone that I can marry, they too could also marry. There isn't a single person on earth that I can marry that they cannot also marry. Because we had the same rights and the same restrictions. Now notice, though, I said, give me the first and last name of a person. And the reason I said that is a reason. Because if you just say, tell me who I can marry that you cannot also marry. They'll say, well, Alan, you can marry the person you love, and I can't. Okay, but that's not true. I don't have the right to just marry any person I love, because maybe the person I love is already married. Maybe they're my relative. Maybe they're a small child. Maybe, I mean, who knows, right? So it's not true that we have the right to marry anyone we love. Okay? That's not what the marriage law says. The marriage law says you can marry anyone so long as they're of the opposite sex, not already married, not a child, and not a close blood relative. I mean, part of that's changed, of course, with same-sex marriage. But again, my point is, homosexuals and heterosexuals have always had the same rights and restrictions. The marriage law applied equally to everyone under its jurisdiction. The second main objection that I heard was, well, Alan, forbidding same-sex couples to marry is like forbidding interracial marriage. And at one point in America, you weren't allowed to marry. If you're a black person, you couldn't marry a white person, you know, and vice versa. And that was wrong to deny that. And so the same kind of inappropriate banning is happening today, or was happening, with same-sex marriage. Now, this argument has tremendous rhetorical force, but it's fundamentally mistaken. And the reason is because, yes, it was was wrong to oppose interracial marriage, but the same mistake is not happening today. Okay? Because race and ethnicity has nothing to do with marriage. But sex is fundamental to marriage, right? There's no difference between a black human being and a white human being because skin color is morally trivial. But sex is not morally trivial. And there's a huge, enormous difference between a man and a woman. Although, as you know, today, with the transgender movement, men and women and that whole difference is being eroded. Trust me, the goal is to eliminate this distinction between men and women. Now, the other problem with this statement is that race and sexual orientation are not parallel in morally relevant ways. And if you weren't here yesterday, you may miss some of this. But when it comes to race, you know, African Americans, for example, in this example, being African American is 100% genetic. It's true that African Americans are born that way. And as I said yesterday, your ethnicity is immutable. You've never seen an African American become Swedish, right? Just impossible. However, when it comes to sexual orientation, this is not the case according to the most current scientific research. Sexual orientation is not genetic, but rather it's mostly environmental. It's the fact that they're not born that way, and it is mutable. And I say, by the way, these statements, not because pastors or Christians have said it, but because gay and lesbian researchers who have been doing the investigation as to what causes same-sex attraction and answering the question, can sexual attractions change, are saying, you're not born that way, and sexual orientation is mutable. It is changeable. If you don't believe me, ask me later or ask me in the Q&A, but I pointed to a number of gay and lesbian researchers yesterday who affirm this. And these are leading thinkers in that area. So I believe that those two objections about interracial marriage and unequal protection under the law are just smokescreens for the real reason why same-sex marriage was legalized. It wasn't about civil rights, right? I don't know if you remember, but in California in 2008, when four Supreme Court justices legalized same-sex marriage in California, at that point, California already had domestic partnership laws, which basically gave two men or two women all the rights of marriage. The only thing it didn't give them was the word marriage. And so it wasn't about rights. They wanted something more. What it was is respect and approval. In fact, Time magazine wrote a story about Andrew Sullivan, who was the leading intellectual force behind same-sex marriage in America today. I don't know if you know who he is, but that's who he was. Listen to what they said about him. The individual who has done the most to push same-sex marriage doesn't even have a boyfriend. In other words, it wasn't like Andrew Sullivan had a boyfriend who he wanted to marry but couldn't because the laws weren't there. No, that's not what it was about. He and the others who brought the marriage lawsuits of the past decade want nothing less, listen carefully, than full social equality, total validation. Not just the right to inherit a mother-in-law's Cadillac. As Andrew Sullivan, the intellectual force behind gay marriage, has written, including homosexuals within marriage is a means of conferring the highest form of social approval imaginable. Same-sex marriage was not about rights. It was about the gay community demanding respect for their lifestyle and total validation for who they are. If you want, we have a quick reference guide. If you aren't able to take notes as much, but over there in the book table, we have a laminated quick reference guide that goes through all of the main arguments and objections and responses to those objections raised against it. My son will be sitting over there if you want. I think it's just a couple bucks, but it's a nice laminated copy. There's a nice summary of that if you want. We have some time to take some questions, and then we'll have some breaks and refreshments before our next presentation. Any thoughts, comments, objections, concerns? Yeah.
I guess a comment. So if memory serves me correctly, prior to the legalization of homosexual marriage or same-sex marriage here in California, there was a law that was passed that actually banned it, if I'm not mistaken. It was recalled. I'm not too sure.
So same-sex marriage was legalized by four judges in California, and then California put on the ballot Proposition 8.
Okay, there you go.
So Proposition 8 would have then removed same-sex marriage. Okay, so again, starting from the past, there was no same-sex marriage in California. Then all of a sudden, judges in California made it legal. And then immediately, the people of California put Proposition 8 on the ballot.
Right.
And guess what? It passed.
Yes.
Now, just think for a moment how amazing that is. California had given same-sex couples the right to marriage. And now we were asking the people of California, which includes places like San Francisco and Hollywood, to remove a right given to same-sex couples. And it passed. Is that unbelievable?
Yeah.
Now, you might say, well, what happened? Well, guess what? One judge in California ruled that the will of the people was unconstitutional and invalidated the entire vote. That judge eventually quit, and it came out that he was gay. So in theory, people argue he should have recused himself, which means if you're a judge and you have a vested interest in the outcome of a case, you're supposed to say, you know what, I can't be an impartial judge in this situation. And many people actually thought or knew that he was a gay man, but it didn't matter. He ruled the will of, I don't know how many millions of voters, unconstitutional,
crazy.
Retired, and now it's over. I mean, in one sense, it may have not mattered because of the 2015 decision, but right. Nevertheless, that's what happened, you know? So even when the will of the people speak,
right.
It's disqualified. And so this is why I'm a little bit cynical about legislative or legal efforts to get things done in America, because if you got the right judges in place, they'll just, you know, decline or disqualify your case. Doesn't matter how good of an argument you have. People say, well, Alan, how can your argument be legitimate? Well, how come the people in the Supreme Court case didn't present your argument? Well, by the way, first of all, it's not my argument. I didn't invent this. These are legal cases that were rendered, but it doesn't matter. You got a bunch of judges to say, okay, nice argument. We're going to disqualify it. There's only so much you can do.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Very frustrating. Good. Any other questions or comments? Yes.
If your gay friend is going to get married and invite you to their wedding, what are you going to do? What are you going to respond?
It's a great question. I'm so glad you asked. Actually, I was expecting that question yesterday. Were you here yesterday?
No.
Okay, that's okay. I'm not trying to embarrass you. Like, why did you come to a... Come on, it was so wonderful. No. Now, so this is a great question. So let me just tell you something. I'll confess that my wife and I have been invited to several same-sex marriages. Now, historically, my wife and I were eager to tell the person who had invited us, because they were a family member, look, we love you, but we do not agree with same-sex marriage, okay? And so we tried to figure out a way to balance that decision or that feeling. Okay, we love them and we want to support them, but not this decision. Now, at the time, we decided to go to that same-sex marriage. But now, in retrospect, we believe we made the wrong decision. And in future invitations, we now have declined. And let me tell you my reasoning for that. A wedding is a very particular type of ceremony. It's a ceremony where everything about that day, everything about the event, everything about the people who have been paid to participate is about one thing, and that is the union of those two individuals. So I don't see how my wife and I, in good conscience, can attend an event that's sole purpose is to celebrate, to lift up and elevate something that God says is not legitimate at all. So now, since then, we have declined and we've done our best to try to say to the person, look, we love you dearly. We know that this is going to be heartbreaking to you. We know this is going to damage our relationship with you. But as best as we can tell you that we care about you and love you, we just can't come. We just can't go. Now, let me just add another note about this. I will just tell you, having personally gone to one, that it, for a Christian who is opposed to same-sex marriage, it is a logistical nightmare to attend a same-sex marriage. Why? Because if you're going to go there and say, well, I'm opposed to same-sex marriage, but I'm just going to go there and try to just be a quiet little person and just be there to say, hey, I love you, but I disagree with this, it doesn't work. You know why? Because every single moment from the ceremony to the afterwards, the reception, is prompting the participants to join in celebrating with them. So here's the question. When the pastor or the officiating person says, I now pronounce you Mr. and Mr. whatever, do you applaud? Do you throw rice at them? When you get them a present? Do you dance at the wedding? When everybody starts to ding their cup to encourage the couple to kiss, do you do that? And if you don't, then you stand out like a sore thumb. Well, how come this couple isn't doing any of that? So I'm telling you, just practically speaking, not that this is an argument against attending one, it is logistically a nightmare if you're in principally opposed to it. So my suggestion now is to do this. If you're invited to a same-sex marriage, you do your absolute best to communicate that you love them, but you cannot attend. But here's what else I suggest you do. I say to the couple, look, I say, when's the date for your ceremony? And let's just say they say February 15th. Okay. I say, when are you coming back from your honeymoon? They say February 27th. I say, okay. I say, can my wife and I come over to your house on March 10th, sometime after that's all over? Now, I ask them that now before their wedding happens. And the reason why I do that is because I want them to know that even though I'm not going to attend their wedding, I still want to have a relationship with them. I still want to pursue them. I still want to love them. I still want to have compassion. And so at least by asking to make plans to come over sometime later, it'll signal to them that at least, well, Alan and his wife, they're still planning to come over. And that might mitigate or lessen the damage done to your relationship. Now, I realize in some cases there's nothing you can do to keep that relationship, because if they're offended and bothered, there might be nothing that you can do. But my wife and I have said, well, let's just at least try to do our best to maintain a friendship. If it doesn't work out, so be it. You know, there's only so much we can do in good conscience. So that's my thoughts on that question. Very tough thing. And if any of you have been to one and you feel like, you know, trust me, I will give grace to people who feel like they've done things and made decisions that are mistakes. Like, my wife and I for decades have had people who identify as gay and lesbian at our home. Family members, coworkers, friends. And many times we've had to make snap decisions because they ask you a question. They ask to do something, and my wife and I have to, like, on the fly, make a decision. Are we going to let him do this? Are we going to let him do that? And sometimes we've made good decisions, and many times we've made bad decisions. And we realize this is uncharted territory for many believers that haven't had an opportunity to, like, the church hasn't had a chance to really process all this and work out the details of what's the best case scenario, what's, you know, going on here. So, I'm the first person to give grace to people who say, yeah, I did this, it was the wrong decision. I'm like, hey, I know, I've been there. So, there you go. Good.
I have a question. You have a neighbor, and they are gay or lesbian couple, and they also have children go to the same school, and they invite your children to come over to their house to have a play date. How you react? Because you don't want to show compassion to them, and you don't want your kids go to their house and feel so weird.
You don't want the kids to go to their house, and you said feel weird?
Yeah, I just don't want the kids go to their house because for us, we tell the kids that's a wrong thing to practice,
What was the last word? Because what?
Because we know it's a sin, right? It's not the same sex marriage is not right for, how should we react to the invitation?
Okay, so this is a great question. It's also a very difficult question because it's partly a parenting question. And I'm always reluctant to give parenting advice because, first of all, every child is unique and different. And how one child might respond in one situation is not a predictor of how another child will respond in the same exact situation. So, for example, like my son is over there in the back. I've taken my son when he was 10 years old to UCLA, which is a secular university, to an abortion protest. And I had him engage people twice his age that were 20 years old on the subject of abortion. Now, would I say that everyone should take their 10-year-olds to a secular university campus at an abortion protest? Absolutely not. Okay? Now, I'm not saying that because he's a genius. I mean, he's a smart kid. But, hey, he's not like some genius, right? He's an average kid, like a lot of us, right? So, again, how one child might respond in one situation is not a predictor for how another child would. So I would say you're going to have to assess in your mind, being the parent, I don't know if you're referring to yourself or a friend of yours, doesn't matter. But the point being is whoever is the parent needs to decide what, based on how well I know my own children, their age, how they've been trained, their tendency to be influenced by other people or to not be influenced by other people, you're going to have to make that decision, okay? So, because it's hard to say, never have any contact with the neighbors. It's like, how is that going to be possible? If your kids go and start playing, riding their bicycles on the street, and the neighbor's kids start riding their bicycles, what do you say? Oh, no, get off the bicycle, come inside. I mean, it's going to become eventually ludicrous. So there's going to be some interaction, but you're going to have to use your best judgment, knowing your children as well as you do, what is an appropriate boundary to set. Now, having said that, my strong conviction is that you are primarily responsible for the training and protection of your children above all other things, okay? So in other words, before my wife and I had children, we would regularly have people who were identifying as gay and lesbian over to our home, okay, for dinner, to spend the night, whatever, okay? Now, when we had young children, we stopped doing that because we didn't want to send the wrong signals to our children about what it means to be a husband and a wife and to be a couple, whatever, you know. So we did certain things because we made that a priority. Now my children are getting older, they understand the subject more, they understand. So now we started to introduce more people in our home that are like that. So the point being is we make the training of our children in the Christian worldview, biblical understanding, as well as truth and compassion as a priority in our children first before we think, well, I don't want to jeopardize this relationship. Maybe it's not your neighbors, maybe it's your sister. Maybe your sister's a lesbian and she's got kids and you don't want to go over to your sister's house. That might strain your sister's relationship with you. My suggestion, make your children a priority first and make your sister's relationship second. Okay. So again, I can't give a specific answer about what to do with the neighbor, but just know that the main principle is you are responsible for your children. That should come first. And then you got to best decide on what you know about your own kids, their age, their tendency to be influenced, and so on, what you're going to allow them to do and not do. So it's more like general principles than they are a specific answer. Is that okay?
Yeah. Yeah, that's fine. If you're already invited to their family,
to their house. I think maybe for it, maybe just say hello. I think maybe find a reason. Yeah, because to the house, I don't think it, to me, I don't feel it's safe or things like that.
Well, sure. If you don't feel something safe, then again, going back, well, I don't know if you were here yesterday, but I talked about the principle of consistency. Were you here yesterday?
Yeah, I was here.
Unlike the girl behind you, right? I mean, not that I want to bring that up again, but no, I'm just kidding. I'm so sorry. Okay, I just couldn't help it. No, so remember I talked about the principle of consistency.
Yes.
You asked the question, what should I do in this situation? Okay? Well, here's your answer. Just think, imagine your neighbor is not a homosexual couple. Maybe there's some other kind of couple. They're not married, but they're boyfriend, girlfriend. Maybe there's other things going on in their home that you feel is unsafe. Would you allow your children to go there? If the answer is no, but that might make them feel like, wait, are you judging us? What can you do? So, again, apply the same rule in a morally comparable situation. And if in one situation you say, no, I don't think I'd allow them to go over inside their house, if they want to ride their bikes outside while the other kids are, okay, fine, but I'm not going to let them go inside. Okay, fine. That's okay. My wife and I have a policy. We don't allow sleepovers. And we just make that a policy over everybody. And so just recently, we were asked, hey, can your son come over? Now, we know that family and trust them, but we said, no, you can't go over. You can't have a sleepover. Like, now, it's a Christian couple. We totally know them. We totally trust them, you know. But we just kind of made a policy. That way, it's off the table. And so if a family member says, hey, can your son come? We're like, no, we just have a policy, no sleepovers. And that just eliminates that from the as an option. And so maybe you decide, okay, our children aren't allowed to be inside a neighbor's house by themselves, and that's just a policy you make, you know. And that way you don't have to worry about it being awkward. If they ask, say, well, actually we just have a policy. Our kids aren't allowed to stay at anyone's house. And that eliminates the awkwardness. It's just an idea, but that's one thing you could also do.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
I just have a question and see what your thought is. I have a lot of clients, and because I work in San Francisco, so I see a lot of gay and lesbian couples.
Yes.
And so they like me a lot. And anyway, so one day, a gay patient came to my office and saw I have a lot of dogs, little dogs, because I'm a dog lover. So the next time he came, he brought one dog to me, but that dog is those rainbow dog, you know, with the seven color, which means...
You said a dog?
A dog. A toy dog.
Oh, doll?
Dog. A dog.
Like woof.
Woof, woof, woof.
But a stuffed dog?
Yes, and okay. Has rainbow color on it, which is an indication of the gay priority. So I say, he wants me to put it to my collection in my office. So... I didn't know how to reject that because I don't want it. And, but he gave me to me out of good intention, though, so I do not really want to, just like what you said, to say no. So I said, oh, okay. So I just put it outside, and he went away. He came to visit me in a few weeks, and then, of course, the dog is not there. So he asked, where's my dog? And I said, oh, it's on the other side. Actually, I hide it behind something because I don't want to throw it away because for some reason I think he will come back and ask. But I really don't want it to be on the table. So what will you do in that case?
Well, this is definitely a question I've never gotten before. Yeah, so, I mean, again, so if it was me, I would ask the question, what would I do if this wasn't about homosexuality, but some other thing? Like it was another type of item that I was principally opposed to. Okay? And if you say, well, I would not include it, then perhaps you would say, okay, then I'm not going to include the rainbow dog as well. But let me ask you a question first. Do you accept other dogs from other patients? Are you a physician?
Yes.
Or a nurse?
I'm an audiologist, so I see patients.
A
I'm an audiologist.
Audiologist?
Yes.
Hence, I couldn't hear you. That's right.
No. So it's my English.
I used to be a physical therapist, so actually I worked with audiologists a lot.
So anyway, yes, the collection actually is from patients that we have good relationship. They see me have dog pictures on my table, so once in a while they'll bring one if they see some cute dogs. So I do have a collection, and I do put it on the table.
Yeah. Right. So, okay, so this is a challenge. I mean, again, you have to either say, I'm going to be willing to accept any dog and just have it be a reflection of who that person is. And maybe every time you see that dog that's got the rainbow, you can just it'd be a trigger for you to remember to pray for them, you know, if you decide to keep it, right? But if not, you're going to have to then, you know, explain to them at some point if they're going to ask, you know. So, and then be willing to accept whatever might come your way, whatever feedback, negative feedback might come your way. This is the same advice that I'd give to somebody who is in business as a Christian, providing a service that they might be asked one day to use for a same-sex wedding. If you're a baker, a seamstress, you know, a photographer, or whatever, you're going to have to decide now, what am I going to do when a lesbian or gay couple asks me to photograph, bake a cake for their wedding? Okay? And you either have to say, I'm going to do it, and just, you know, I'm not going to agree with it, but I'm going to photograph it, or decline it and potentially receive a lawsuit or negative pushback, or number three, I'm going to get out of the business of doing this particular service altogether. Those are your three options, right? So in the same way, you're going to have to decide the same thing. Am I, number one, going to just, in a sense, plug your nose and accept it, and just maybe try to use it for good? Like, hey, every time I see that, I'm going to remember to pray. It's not so much it's advocating gay pride. It's a trigger for me to remember to pray for the individuals who have given me these dogs. Or say, no, I'm going to not accept it, but then realize you're going to have to potentially accept backlash. Or number three, get out of the business of taking in dogs from patients. You know, I'm not sure what I would do. It's a tough situation, but to me, those are your options, unless you can think of another option.
No, nothing. Yeah. I have another question for you. Again, since I work in San Francisco, I see a lot of these, and one of my coworkers is actually a lesbian, and I just want to see what you think. Just now you were saying that the function of family by nature is to produce children.
The next generation.
Yes, the next generation. So she has her partner, and they really want to have a family, so they want to have some have children. So what they did is, my coworker's wife went and bought some sperms from the reserve center. What do you call it? Sperm bank.
So, oh, sperm bank. Yes.
And she has two baby. Uh-huh. And so, your thing is function of families by nature produce children or next generation. Now, the way they do it, they can also have offspring, which is not a woman and a man, or husband
right.
and wife.
Right.
So, so your base against same-sex marriage, in this case, what's your thinking?
So remember I said that long-term monogamous heterosexual unions, as a rule, as a group, by nature, produce the next generation. So it's not the rule that lesbian couples produce the next generation, because they can't in principle do it. Whatever they're doing is not a procreative act. It's certainly not the group of lesbian couples that's largely responsible for producing kids, and it's certainly not by nature. So, of course, there's going to be exceptions, but this isn't even an exception to the rule. It's just a situation where they're going through a sperm bank, and again, denying the child their father, and denying a child one male, one gender influence. So it's harmful to the child, and it doesn't actually meet the criteria of long-term monogamous heterosexual union as a rule, as a group by nature. So to me, it doesn't qualify in the same way in that case.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I don't know how we're doing on time, or if we have more. Oh, great, yes.
We still have time.
Okay, good.
Thank you for your message. It really helped me to think out of the box, because most time when we talk about the marriage, we always come back to Bible. So your message this afternoon more to the non-believers, to the people, I have a question. Like, normally when we talk to other people, we talk to the youth, we talk to the children inside our family, we always come back to the Bible.
Yes.
Okay. So I have a question. So for most of the homosexual, you know, are there any Christians who, like, they want to get into the same-sex marriage? Yesterday you talked about we need to accept those people. We need to have passion, be passionate to those people. But today's topic is different. The same-sex marriage, we don't agree for this practice at all. So what is the question or church? What should be our attitude for the people who are in or they intend to go into the same-sex marriage? And also looking far, moving forward, will church have issue if they refuse to hold the same-sex marriage ceremony? So what do you think about this?
Okay, so the first question, though, is, I'm trying to understand it. Are you asking if a Christian couple asks to be married as a same-sex couple? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
You're asking
what
should the church's response be?
Do you know any people who are true Christian and they still want to get into the same-sex marriage?
Oh, well... Well, yeah, so I don't know what you mean by true Christian, but...
Born again
they
Christian.
let me put it this way. They are professing to be Christians and saying they're getting married. Absolutely. There are, unfortunately, a lot of people who are doing this. And I mean, I wouldn't say it's a majority, but it is a growing number of Christians who have accepted homosexuality and now are saying that even as a Christian, you can get married to another person of the same sex. And, I mean, there's... As I said yesterday, there's many denominations that have officially said we will marry same-sex couples and or allow them to be pastors, leaders in the church. Okay. Now, my response to that is, once you claim to be a Christian, once you are professing Christ, I'm not going to judge whether that's legitimate or not. However, once you profess to be a Christian, you now fall under the jurisdiction of Scripture. And so I am going to call upon Scripture to show where your behavior or theology is mistaken. And we are at that point, unlike with same-sex marriage, when I'm talking here about secular arguments, it's totally appropriate, once they profess Christ, to then bring in the Bible to correct or address them. Okay? And so that's one thing I do, and I have a lot of articles on our website at str.org that address professing Christians who are advocating either homosexual theology or same-sex marriage, okay? Now, your second question was about what happens in the future with the church if they decline to use their church as a place. Well, sometimes nothing happens, but sometimes the couple comes back and sues the church and says that the government is giving the church a tax break, because I'm assuming, like, for example, your church is a nonprofit, is that right? So people who give to the church through tithing, their contributions are tax deductible because you have a nonprofit status. That status will then be removed from the church, and therefore the giving from the congregation will not be tax deductible to them, which will of course reduce giving, and it makes the church struggle financially. So that's the potential. Many, not all churches this has happened to, but there are a lot of churches where it's happened. Especially if your church has an especially very pretty or unique, chapel, or it's in the mountains, or it has some beautiful view, then, you know, strangers will want to come to your church and ask to use your church for a same-sex marriage. So there is an organization called Alliance Defending Freedom that is created. They're a legal organization that protects churches and Christian schools to help them create bylaws and church membership principles that will help to lessen the likelihood that they will get a lawsuit. And they've produced a document called, okay, I forgot the name of it, but I can send it to you, to your pastor, to Howard. And it's a full thing that teaches you principles on how to create policies in your church with membership and marriage laws and whatever that will help reduce the likelihood that you'll get sued. If you just remind me, I'll send it to you.
Okay.
But it's a great document, and they and the ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom, were responsible for defending, you've probably heard of Jack Phillips, the baker in Colorado, who has been sued multiple times. They protected him. They won that case. The guy who did the T-shirts, they defended him. So these are very skilled attorneys, and they understand these ideas very well. And their handbook has been helpful. I've encouraged many churches and schools to use it to help protect in those situations.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Yes. Yeah. Many churches that I've talked to say we are willing to give up our tax deductional status in order to not have to accept same-sex marriages. But, you know, depending on your church, I mean, that could be financially very difficult.
Yeah. Hi, Anna, I have a question. You mentioned that government approved marriage or family on the basis about being able to naturally produce children. Right?
Yes.
And I think there's a self-contradiction regarding government behavior now, because as a normal couple, we know for quite a, some of them, they couldn't naturally produce the children.
Yes.
Then the government allowed them to adopt children from around the world. So maybe some people will use this as an evidence to say, well, this family, they can't naturally produce children, then maybe they should be disqualified as a family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
yes.
What's your comment?
Yes, that's a common objection that's raised against my view. It's true, not all heterosexual marriages produce children, but every child has a mother and a father, and they have a right to know their mother and their father, and they have a right to the stability of their parents. And so the child can't themselves protect that right, which is why the government needs to do it. So that would be my first thought, is that yes, not all heterosexual couples have kids, but every kid has a mother and a father. And that's why we still need to say that this is an institution about responsible procreation. Second of all, even if some marriages don't produce kids, that does not nullify the tie of marriage to procreation. Because think about it. Books are meant to be read, even if some books are used as a doorstop or used to start a campfire, right? So just because some parents don't have children, some couples don't have kids, it doesn't nullify the natural tie of marriage to procreation. So that'd be my two responses. Again, it's acknowledging that's the case, but realizing that that doesn't in any way disqualify the broader point that we're making. And one in the back as well. Howard, you let us know when we're at times, okay? Yep. Okay. Good.
I just want to ask a question. I guess I asked it last night when all the youth were here. How do you preserve the next generation? Because we're talking about children.
I can't see where you are.
I'm over here.
Oh, there you are. How do we what? Preserve?
How do you preserve our, because I guess we have a big youth group here.
Yes.
How do you preserve the next generation from this homosexual thing saying it's normal because they were pounded by school? Like every single day say they are normal, you cannot discriminate against them. I mean, that's fine.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think last time I was talking to you, like they enforce that the majority,
yes,
of heterosexuals to follow the concept of a homosexual.
Yes.
And then keep pounding to your kids, say it's normal. So it's become like a fashionable, like people wear Nike, like That's a brain. I mean, I'm boasting. It used to be a shame, but now everybody's boasting about. So how do you preserve next generation, especially raised in a Christian family?
Yeah, that's a great question.
That they can against this tie.
Yes, this is a great question. And I just want to echo your concern and feeling of outrage about how it used to be considered shameful, but now it's fashionable. And in fact, I remember a doctor, a psychiatric doctor, saying that some of the kids that come to his practice who express confusion or whatever come out and tell him that they are transgender. And when he asks why, he would hear them, many of them say, it's kind of cool to say you're transgender, you know. And it's almost like being transgender is sort of the new hip thing to do or be, okay. So yes, you're absolutely right. This is a big problem. And your question is, well, how do we preserve the next generation? And I mean, I don't have an answer that's going to be, oh, wow, I never thought about that. So I apologize if this answer is going to sound boring, but the answer is, it's through proper discipleship of our young people. It's through proper education. If the church does what it's supposed to do, and that is properly educate in age-appropriate ways, what is marriage? What is male? What is female? What does the Bible say about it? How do we know this is true? If we do proper theological education, catechism, and discipleship, then I believe this is the best way to preserve the next generation. If you think about it, and I think maybe I mentioned this yesterday, but the first century church, it was worse than now here in America, right? I mean, at least in America, we still have the remnants of a post-Christian culture where there's still some elements where we say, you know, human beings are valuable. You know, there are some senses in which people say, yeah, there are males and females. And yes, it is wrong to do these. I mean, there is still some remnants of a Christian culture present. First century church, they had just a very small church. I mean, the church at Corinth, I don't know, was it 50 people, 100? I don't even know, right? It's small. And they had the entire world and their surrounding culture against them. And so they had all of the odds against them. But yet they were able to disciple the next generation, and that generation discipled the next generation, and so on and so forth. And so if every church were to properly implement a educational program and not just, and I don't want to step on your toes, I'm here to tell you how to run your church, but in my opinion, if I could decide how a church would run, we wouldn't just rely on what's being preached from the pulpit to be the sole source of education, but we would have a rigorous educational program as well in the church where we're training and catechizing young people from a very early age, teaching them theology, teaching them apologetics, teaching them worldview, because these are all the things that inoculate against the false ideas of our culture. The principle that we teach at Stand to Reason is this: don't isolate, inoculate. And typically what the church has done is isolation. They take young people and they isolate them from false ideas. They say, oh, I don't want my kids to hear about evolution and abortion and homosexuality because it'll poison their minds. The problem with that approach is that when you isolate your children from this, they eventually grow up and they go off to high school or college, and then they run across somebody who is very thoughtful and educated that holds false ideas. And then the young student says, wow, I'm totally taken aback. I didn't know there were arguments for evolution or abortion or homosexuality. And now they've been isolated their whole life and they're completely shocked and they don't know what to do. And now they're having a crisis of faith. The better way to protect the next generation is to inoculate them. So think about it with me. How do we inoculate missionaries or whoever goes off to, say, a country like some country in Africa that has, I don't know, polio? What do we do to inoculate against polio? What do we give people? We give them a vaccine of polio. And do you know what it contains? It contains polio. So before you go off to the country, you actually ingest, or I don't know if they give you a thing, but you literally drink or eat polio virus, a weakened or a dead form of polio. Now what happens? Your body takes it in and your immune system says, hey, what is this thing? I don't know, but let's create some antibodies. Let's create an immune system ready to destroy polio. So then years later, or 6 months later, you go to a country, then you get exposed to the real polio, and your body is not surprised. It says, oh, I know what this is. I've seen it before. It's polio, and I have an army of antibodies ready to destroy it. We need to do the same thing with young people. We need to inoculate them to false ideas, which means we teach them the false ideas enough. We teach them about evolution and homosexuality and abortion or whatever these things are, naturalism, relativism. We teach them what they are and arguments for why they're true as well as arguments against why they're true. That way, when the student goes off to university or to high school or wherever, and they run across a student who says, oh, you're a Christian? You believe God made us? Oh, you're so stupid. You know, because evolution's true. Here are three arguments for evolution. But now the Christian student who's been inoculated says this, oh, I've heard of those three arguments. In fact, I can give you two more arguments why evolution is true. But now let me tell you five arguments against all of those, why they're false. So the student, the Christian student, knows the arguments in favor of evolution better than the kid who actually believes in evolution. When that kid who's inoculated goes off to college, you will not see them having a crisis of faith. They will be agents of change in their sphere of influence. So that's why I say we just got to do better education. We got to do discipleship. We got to train in theology and apologetics and worldview and inoculate the next generation so they're not caught off guard when they're exposed to these ideas.
I'm a bit perplexed about how you balance your compassion and your conviction. Your compassion to the homosexuality people and your conviction of your faith and belief. I don't believe your compassion is toward them is more of condemnation or acceptance of their behavior or their sin. But at the same time, how can you continue to be their friend and love them? At the same time, you feel that it's wrong to have that kind of a lifestyle. I just don't know how you can balance that. Loving them at the same time would uphold your faith.
Are you asking how theologically that's permitted, or are you asking how I personally can handle that?
Like, well, you give several examples that you and your wife or your family has lots of friends who happen to be homosexual, mm-hmm. and you even attend one of the weddings. So, and you want to continue to build that relationship with them and possibly love them as well. But at the same time, I feel that you don't believe in, well, you convinced me about the same-sex marriage is wrong. It's not, shouldn't be there. So, but how do you balance? Because I personally don't know how to do so.
Well, I would say this. I mean, just think of any friend or family member you have that's not a believer. Do you have any friends or family that aren't believers? Okay. Do you love them?
Yeah.
Well, so chances are, I'm just going to step going on a limb here, but I bet they're doing things that are immoral. Maybe they cheat on their taxes. Maybe they download movies illegally or MP3. No. I'm not saying we turn a blind eye. I'm just saying the question of, if a person is engaged in sin, does that mean automatically I can't love them? And I think the answer is no. We still can love them, but not agree with what they're doing. So that doesn't mean, though, that in every conversation, like you meet someone, or no, not meet someone, you go over to your Uncle Bob's house. I know you probably don't have an Uncle Bob, but just pretend you have an Uncle Bob, okay? You go over to Uncle Bob's house, and you know he cheats on his taxes every year. Okay, he doesn't open up the door and say, hey, welcome. You're like, you cheated on your taxes. That's a sin. Like, you'd never do that. You'd You'd come in, you'd sit down, you'd have a meal, whatever. I mean, now, if the opportunity came where you had the chance to present the gospel, then you take the chance to present the gospel. So, and that may or may not include him stealing from the government, okay? Because I believe that the gospel presentation always has to be preceded by the bad news before you can present the good news. The bad news is, you've done wrong, you're guilty, and you deserve to be punished. That's the bad news, right? God's going to punish you. The good news is that God's also willing to offer you a pardon to not be punished, right? So, you could still love the person, build a relationship, and then maybe have then the opportunity to present the gospel to them. And so my relationships with friends and family who identify as gay and lesbian aren't marked by me turning a blind eye to their sin. I'm fully aware of their sin. But I realize if I just walk in the door and slam them with, hey, you're a sinner, that relationship's not going to last for more than a second, right? So I'm not turning a blind eye. I'm thinking, how can I strategically have an opportunity to share the gospel with them? I'm going to build a relationship with them. I'm going to love them. And almost invariably, any relationship I have with someone, once they know me enough, they're going to find out I'm a Christian, and they're going to ask me, what do I think about this, this, and that? Or how, you know? And then I have an opportunity to present the gospel. So my ultimate goal is to do that so that they can become saved. Once the Holy Spirit comes into their life, the Holy Spirit convicts them of sin, and now we can start talking about, you know, where what areas in their life are they're in sin.
Perhaps put it this way. I think for Willis, it's maybe something like, yes, we want to maintain the relationship. So obviously, you know, we have the gay couple getting married, so we attending. But by attending, being so physical in public, how would we being avoid, you know, seen as Christian endorsing same-sex marriage when we were taking a stand to against it? But then when we're attending, then people would say, oh, that's an endorsement. So
you mean attending a same-sex marriage?
Right, right.
Well,
right.
I don't recommend we attend a same-sex marriage.
Oh, okay.
I was saying that that's what we did, but we felt it was a mistake.
Oh, okay, okay.
Right? So even though that's what we did.
Poe has a question, and then after to Cindy, and then we're watching our time, okay?
Yeah. Okay. I want to share some thoughts that I have on homosexual and same-sex marriage. After hearing your talk, I'm thinking, at one hand, as a Christian, you tell us that we should show compassion, show love to a homosexual person, and to have empathy with them. Towards the end, hopefully, we can bring them to Christ. So, even I think in the schools, it's also teaching to have accommodation, respect them, accept who they are, and to love them too. So, I generally feel that maybe are we actually a little bit soft, in towards them? Because I think what leads to a same-sex marriage is that I think as a society we are too soft, and they actually take things for take our favor, our love, and go against it and demands more, and people or the homosexual community actually demands more. They want to have equal rights, same-sex marriage. So why in the old days, where homosexual actually exists in the Old Testament, and people don't demand same-sex marriage? Because at that society, I think at that time, people are very vocal and strongly against. So today, as a church, if we are like others, people who are the non-believers, who show compassion, show love, and in a softer manner, I think maybe as a body of Christ, we need to be stronger. To stand up.
So are you saying that by us showing compassion and love towards them, we are acting like the secular culture is?
Maybe I give you an example. It's like if your son actually, or if my son actually commit some sin, very serious sin. I think as a parent, you were in the Asian culture, we will cane our children.
We kill our children?
No, kin.
Kin.
In U.S. will not be. Yeah. What I'm trying to say, during my school days, we have public caning.
Yes.
Yeah. Cane. So nowadays, it's becomes too soft. Yeah. So in a sense that if our belief also become very soft, then that's what happening in the society now.
Yeah. Can you give me an example of how we Christians are soft on this example? On this
I
topic?
Think I'll hearing maybe you give me the impression that we need to approach them in a softer manner. Yeah.
Okay, look at your time, all right?
I think what he's saying is that in the absence of a deterrent, where Christians show so much compassion and love that it becomes affirming for homosexuals to the extent that there are no consequences. And so they would take that compassion and say, well, great, you know, I am accepted. And so in the absence of those deterrents, like I was saying yesterday, if somebody steals something, there are obvious consequences. I think that's what Poe, my brother here, is trying to say. You know, there's no strict, you know, consequences, be it caning or whipping. Right. You know, there's no consequences. So therefore, but I think, you know, my take on that is, you know, we are beyond the law, right? We come to Christ, and it is out of love and His grace that we follow Him, and it's not by the law that spells out what we can do or what we can't do.
Okay.
But it's I think it's always difficult. I don't think there's a right answer, because every encounter we have with, you know, be it a homosexual couple or anybody else, it's going to be unique and different. Whether it's the child who's got, you know, homosexual parents or our neighbors or, you know, coworkers, every situation is different. I think all we can do is just to pray and ask for wisdom and how to act.
So, are either of you offering an example of what a consequence could be?
Well,
that would signal that we're not soft.
Well, no, that would be disapproval. So disapproval
sure.
You know, outward disapproval by not being so accommodating.
Okay, but are you suggesting that my message has communicated that we should not express disapproval?
No.
Oh, okay. Because I feel
I don't
like,
know what he I don't know what he's trying to, you know,
right,
as far as where
like,
he's
yeah.
at.
So but. I feel like I've tried to say that we should
I think
not
that's very subjective as to how you define that line. So let's not spend time
Let me just say that I feel like what I've been trying to communicate is we should not compromise on the morality of homosexuality, that it is a sin. We hold that view, and in fact, I've been doing everything I can to argue against Christians who say it is okay.
Yes.
That's what a big portion of yesterday's first half of the presentation was about. What does God say? And we don't compromise that. All I'm now adding was that does not mean when you see a homosexual, you cane them. Or you you shame them. Or how about we first have some try to at least build the relationship before we get to the point where we say this is sin.
So okay? I'm not
just like with Jesus, he regularly would interact with people who feels like, wait, you're interacting with this Samaritan person, with this person here, like what? So he initiates a relationship first, and then has an opportunity to present truth. You know, I'm just simply saying we should try.
Sorry about that. Okay. Listen, guys. The church has been treating divorce and remarriage. It's been a controversy for a long time. But homosexuality is a new territory. We welcome people who broken marriage and divorce with those the same kind of acceptance and love and support. Now change it to homosexual. It's the same way. But we're so foreign to it. We don't know how to deal with it yet. But think of it just like people who are divorced. The church never encouraged that. Yet it happened to them, and there are people divorced and remarried and kicked into church. And we have likened them and do it the same way. So just leave it at that, okay? And furthermore, you can do it through personal email. Last question here, and then we have a break. Come on.
No, that's okay. Mine is just a comment. We can hold.
All right, Pastor Howard. Let's say prayer, and people have refreshment because we do have another group of people coming here in 4:30.
Okay. Oh, okay.
We can tell that this debate is very spirited. It's something that affects us. It affects our children. It's on our minds. It's somewhere that's underneath that doesn't necessarily has a spoken voice. These are the exact opportunities. This is the safe place where we can talk about these things. I just want to say one thing. You know, hearing all these things and about compassion and truth and all these things, I just want to just one Bible verse, Romans 5:8. But God demonstrates His love in this, that while we were still yet sinners, Christ died for us. Yes, we have to recognize the sin. But, you know, and we always have to say, forgive me. Or to say, I'm sorry, to receive that grace. But that can never, ever happen if we don't establish that relationship first. Jesus never, ever shamed anyone into the gospel. In fact, those He shamed were the ones He said, you don't belong in My kingdom. Everyone else, you know, whether it was adultery. Yes, she's an adulteress. Yes, you know, yes, the law states you need to stone her. Well, what did He say? Let he who has not sinned cast the first stone. I'm just going to leave it at that. This is a very passionate thing. It really is. And it affects us in tremendous ways. I would suggest that we write these things down. Our brother Alan has been so gracious with our comments and concerns, and this would be a great opportunity to converse with him. There's lots of materials outside that we can look at too. And I'm sure Alan's always welcome to talk to you guys. But let's close with a word of prayer because we do have refreshments. Let's pray. Whew. Gracious God in heaven, we thank you for your mercy and your love for us, God, that we would have this opportunity to talk in real ways, Lord, about not just, hypotheticals, but Father, even at times real life situations with coworkers, with family members and whatnot. Lord, we understand that this is a very sensitive topic and we have a lot invested into this. Not only just intellectually, but emotionally, Father, that we're so tied into all of these things. So Father, I ask for your grace over us. Father, will the peace that transcends all knowledge come upon us, Lord? That we would have rest in you. Father, that even though that we don't have the wisdom now, that we can have faith that your love, your grace transcends all things and that includes the wisdom that we have. God, I just pray that you would instill into us this passion, Lord, of why you sacrificed your son. Because you found it that we were worth it. God, may your mercy be upon us. May your grace cover us, Lord. We thank you for Brother Alan and all that he shared. And God, we just ask for your blessings over the food that we receive. And that this time will be a true blessing. And that we could talk honestly with one another. We thank you for your love and we thank you for this body and all these wonderful questions, Lord. May that thirst of knowledge never be quenched and may we always seek you for guidance. We thank you for your favor and love. We bless you, Father. We pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.